Next case on the calendar for oral argument is SRRT Properties versus Nova Consulting Group. Good morning, Council. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. You will each have 15 minutes for your arguments. Counsel for appellant, you will have 5 minutes reserved for you for rebuttal. It's important that you identify who you represent and state your name when you begin your arguments, and you can adjust the podium by with the button underneath to raise or lower it as suits your needs. I think with that, Counsel for appellant, I assume one counsel is arguing on behalf of the appellant.
That's okay. Correct, Your Honor.
All right. Thank you, and you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning to you all, and may it please the court. I'm Paul Esposito, and with Michael Hague and Elena Harvey, I represent Nova Consulting. First of all, I thank the court for allowing me to appear and argue pro hac vice. I know that's a privilege, and I appreciate being given it. The first issue is duty. It generally is. Duties flow from relationships, the relationships that the law says someone here owes a duty to protect another person. There was no relationship here. At the time we entered into our contract with the lender, at the time we set the terms, the ASTM standard that was governing our observations, the observations itself, the report itself, SRT wasn't around. They were not part of anything. SRT showed up in this matter in about 3 weeks after we did our report, when they asked the lender, not us, if they could use this report. The lender, as you know, turns to Nova. Nova had been working with the lender for a long time. The lender asked Nova, would you mind if we added them into paragraph 2.3? Nova said approved.
With the effect being they got to see the report and could use it in the same way that the lender could use it.
Exactly. The terms of 2.3 are very clear that it can be used for the purpose of evaluating a request for credit and for no other purpose.
I have a more fundamental question on duty, and maybe I'm just missing it. I saw a motion for summary judgment denied because there were fact issues for a jury on duty. I don't see anywhere that the jury was asked a fact issue to decide a fact issue on duty. Am I missing something?
You're not missing anything.
How did that happen?
I don't know. You know, I mean, I didn't try the case, but, you know, reading the transcripts, the court said, you know, we think there's a question of fact as to duty. But when you look at the special verdict, there's 14 questions there. Not a single one of them said duty. Not a single one said foreseeability or foreseeable. The issue wasn't presented to the jury, which frankly seems to be the way the law should be. Duty is foreseeability as relates to duty has traditionally been a question of law. I know from just doing the research on the case that there is a little bit of I'll call it a struggle. I've seen the I think it's Fenrich case where two justices on the Supreme Court disagreed with the court's ruling that it can go to the jury, but it didn't. It didn't get there. The jury was never told that they needed to resolve an issue of foreseeability to determine whether there was a duty in the case.
But it does strike me, counsel, that it was hotly contested that where you started your argument, which is whether there's a relationship between Nova
right.
and the plaintiff, that was raised to the jury and hotly contested. Certainly there are certain facts that are undisputed, which is there's no contract relationship between the two, things like that. But in terms of that email exchange that you outlined
right.
and what the impact of that was and whether a duty arose when Nova responded, approved, that was all laid out to the jury, wasn't it?
Oh, there was. You know,
and they could have gone either way.
They, I suppose they could have plaintiff presented the facts, but the question was, in Minnesota procedure, as I understand it, is the jury's answer special verdicts. That was never given them to answer.
The duty question isn't on the verdict form. I don't think anybody's arguing about
yeah.
that. But in
but
terms no, of
neither was foreseeability.
You know, as we all understand tort law, many of these elements are elements that that are interconnected or related. So justifiable reliance has some relationship to damages. Foreseeability has a causal element as well as a duty element. And so the brunt of the issues, and certainly all of the contested evidence, or the contested inferences from the evidence, that all went to the jury. And as I said, it's my review is it could have gone either way, and that there is evidence supporting the jury's determination that when Nova said approved, it could expect SRRT to rely on the report. And then we get this whole issue of, is the scope of their reliance reasonable? That's another hotly contested issue. Evidence went both ways on that.
Well, there's evidence. I mean, plaintiff put on a case, but...
Well, you did too. I mean,
and we did too.
Yeah, absolutely. Exactly. Witnesses went both sides.
Know, but the question came down to, excuse me, when you get to the question of foreseeability, let's just stay there for a moment if we can. The question is, was it foreseeable at the time we were doing all this work, at the time we were making up this contract, we were observing the building, was it reasonably foreseeable at that point?
I don't understand.
Because that's when we're working.
I don't know why it would have to be foreseeable at the time that Nova did the inspection. If they are later clearly asked, is it okay for SSRT to rely on the building conditions report that Nova prepared, and Nova responds, approved.
But what they were clearly asked, Your Honor, is if they could be included in paragraph 2.3.
Well, that for was underwriting purposes,
right.
because SRRT was evaluating its position with respect to purchase of the property.
Well, that's
if you read the entirety of the emails, that's what it suggests.
Right, but that was not what was communicated. Go to
well,
that first email.
It might not have been what Nova understood. That's a subjective question. What did they understand? The jury got all of that. I mean, and it was vigorously argued. So it seems to me, as long as there's evidence in the record to support the jury's determinations on negligent misrepresentation, I mean, what more is it for this court to do?
Well, the problem here, Your Honor, I think you have to take this in steps, is the email, the original email that came from the plaintiffs went to, not to Nova, but they went to the lender. And they said, you know, we've got this issue we needed for valuation, transfer valuation, I think is how they called it, et cetera, et cetera. Can we get the report? Without telling us, because we didn't get the email in the first place, without telling us, the lender says, Nova's got to approve this. So then the lender sends us an email, copies them in, and says, hey, look, they want it for their underwriting purposes. Is it okay if we added them into paragraph 2.3? There's never at any time communication between the plaintiff and Nova about this subject. And Nova had been working with these, you know, with the lender for 30, 40 deals, and they did it as a favor. That was how it came down. But then you have to go to 2.3. You know, if they're going to be put in that, they've got to take the bidder with the better. They can't just say, oh, we're in 2.3. Now we can rely on this for whatever we want to. They have to accept 2.3 for how it is worded to them, and that is it can be used for an evaluation of credit and for no other purpose.
But doesn't an evaluation of credit turn on the condition of the property and the fact that there's $800,000 in, I think, what you now describe as, you know, long overdue maintenance, has got to go to what's the value for credit purposes of the property, doesn't
Not
it?
Not necessarily, because I think what the courts have said, the Dotson case, I think it's Loeb versus Dotson, the courts have said, you can't look at the repair cost to determine value because there's a lot that goes into what is repair cost. There's insurance issues that go in there. There's profit issues that go in there. There's labor issues that go into what a contractor wants to do the work. It doesn't, none of that stuff necessarily goes to the value. That's why, as we get into this out-of-pocket rule, that's why the out-of-pocket rule says, look at You have to come in with the with something that shows the value of the property at the time you received it. The measure of damages in misrepresentation cases is the difference between what you paid for it and what was the value after it. It applies in misrepresentation cases, whether fraudulent or negligent. The only time it doesn't apply is if you're dealing with you're dealing with a property or an interest that really can't be valued that way, with the loss of a business, something that doesn't work that way. The court said, the courts have said that when you're dealing with real estate, it is a it's really the perfect situation where you would apply this. And we're dealing with real estate here, the value of this property.
So let me ask you a couple questions
Sure.
about your measure of damages argument. I just want to make sure I understand it correctly. I know there was some disagreement during the trial about how the jury should be instructed. Is your issue on appeal a request for a new trial because this jury was improperly instructed? Or is it some, and I'm just narrowing it down just to the damages issue.
Right.
Just looking at damages.
Right.
Or is it something else?
It's something else.
Okay.
Or
evidentiary. I wondered that as well, because you certainly objected to introduction of the evidence of the cost of repairs, and some of that was resolved in a motion in limine. So is that your request on appeal?
This does turn, too, to an issue of law, because damages are based upon measures set by the law. And what we were saying, that both as to negligent misrepresentation and as to negligence, the court applied the wrong measure of law.
So you're not seeking a new trial on either the evidentiary.
Alternatively, we
if you
could.
Just let me finish,
I'm sorry,
counsel.
I'm sorry.
No, that's all right. I think you're reading my mind, which is fine. I just want to have it clear in my own head. So you're not seeking a new trial because this jury was improperly instructed on damages. Is that right?
We're seeking
on appeal. You're not asking
right, on appeal. We're seeking judgment. Because the correct measure of damages would get them zero under the facts that they presented in this case.
Because there's no evidence to the correct measure of damages,
right? No evidence
right?
to the correct measure.
Okay.
As to the misrepresentation, Your Honor. As to the negligence, we're seeking judgment. Because there's, again, there is using the measure of damages that they put in front of the court, there are no damages.
So now that I understand the issue, it seems to me if this court determines that the evidence of cost of repairs, that evidence is relevant and does go to the measure of damages, say for negligent misrepresentation, then we would affirm the damages determination on this issue. Again, I know you have that remittitor argument.
Just on this
issue.
Yeah, you know, if the correct measure of damages was given, that argument would fall out. And as you say, we do have the remittitor, we have the limitation damages argument, so we're still standing on them. But because we're at damages, I just wanted to point out what the negligent inspection claim, the measure of damages was here. And I cited on page 32 of our brief. This is from, I believe, Civ Jig 92.10, and it says, plaintiff's damages for negligent inspection claim are the reasonable cost of repair for restoring the damaged property to be substantially the same question as it was before the harm. What that is saying is that the damages to the plaintiff are the damages to the property. You're looking in this negligent inspection claim, the jury is to be looking at what damages to the building did the defendant cause.
But and the damages instruction was bigger than that. You're quoting a very small
portion of the sure.
damages instruction. It went on to say, damages for misrepresentation are limited to any damages that were directly caused by relying on the misrepresentation. Reliance damages is a pretty standard instruction in a negligent misrepresentation case. And it seems you don't argue that that was improper on appeal, so it seems to me the jury was given, under Minnesota law, the correct law on damages.
It wasn't, Your Honor, because the Supreme Court and the appellate court of appeals has said what the measure of damages is in a misrepresentation case. I'm trying right now to deal with these separately. In a misrepresentation case, fraudulent or negligent, whatever, the measure of damages is governed by the out-of-pocket rule. That's what we're saying. That is our position. In the measure in the negligent inspection claim, the measure of damages is governed by what damages to the property did the defendant cause. And so, the plaintiffs have admitted that we did no damage. In fact, Brad Schaefer said those repairs were necessary whether or not Nova ever saw or did anything at the building.
So I've got a question for you to think about for your rebuttal time, and that is, you know, I'm in looking at this case, yes, the two different theories were submitted to the jury, negligent inspection and negligent misrepresentation, but there's one determination of damages. So I'm just wondering if this court even needs to examine both theories, or as long as we were to find that this jury was properly instructed and that the law was properly applied and that the evidence supported the jury's findings on one of them, we would be done.
I can answer that now,
okay.
I think, Your Honor.
Okay.
You know, I think that if plaintiff wins on whatever count, they win the damages that are available on that count. They presented two counts. They don't have to win on both counts.
All right,
and so that they get the damages that are available under that count, which based on the law and the evidence, is zero. Thank you.
Thank you. Counsel for respondent.
May it please the court, counsel. Curtis Smith appearing on behalf of the respondent, SRRT Properties. This case was hotly contested at trial. And to answer your question, Judge Bjorkman, why foreseeability wasn't separately submitted?
But why duty? Why wasn't the duty and all, especially foreseeability, but the question of relationship? I mean, the district court says no summary judgment because there's a fact issue as to whether a duty is owed, and then no question is asked to the jury.
Defendant never asked for it, Your Honor. Look at the defendants in jury instructions, which is document number 65 in the trial record.
So you say they forfeited the issue by not asking for a jury instruction?
I think they waived the issue by not asking for a jury instruction, and I think the law is clear about that. Look at document 64 again in the trial court record. Is their special verdict form, and it's virtually identical to what the court submitted. I think it was incumbent on the defendant, if they wanted that factual issue to be determined, to at least ask for it at some point, either in the charging conference, in the requested instructions,
I would agree with you on that if that was exactly the issue they were raising on appeal, but I don't hear them raising this was a defective verdict form, we get a new trial on that basis. Instead, it seems to me they're raising more legal challenges out of the JMOL. And so I'm not quite sure I follow where your argument takes us.
Well, if I might, Your Honor, they're raising both. They've raised the issue in their brief, I think it may have been in their reply brief, where they stated the trial court should have done this on its own. They admit that it wasn't requested, admit that it, you know, in response to the argument I made, it wasn't requested, it wasn't asked. It's not like they asked Judge Klein to submit this question and he said no. It just wasn't done. Number two, I think it's subsumed in the jury instruction, the jig that was given, the portion on foreseeability, which is a bracketed portion in the jig, was given in this case as requested by both parties. The question of the question of as a matter of law, Your Honor, whether the whether it was foreseeability, which is really a question, should Judge Klein have thrown this case out on summary judgment, right? And I would stand on his
or denied summary judgment on the grounds that as a matter of law this was foreseeable and this was the sort of relationship on which a duty can be imposed.
Right, either
but
way.
But this court did something else. I mean, this district court said, "Nope, that's for the jury. I'm generally it is for the a district court judge to decide those kinds of issues, and that's part of the judge's gatekeeper role. And this judge decided, nope, I'm passing that role on to a jury, and then didn't do so. Seems to me that's a bigger issue than what a party asked for in a jury instruction. Why am I wrong about that?
Well, Judge Klein, I believe, followed the law on summary judgment, where the Supreme Court has said in rare cases, and he found it was one here, that the issue of foreseeability is for the jury, or maybe for the jury. And I think it's incumbent on the parties, Your Honor, to ask for jury instructions on issues and for special verdict questions on issues that they want the jury to decide. It's not the trial judge's job. I mean, we lawyers get paid a lot of money to do what we do, you know, and part of it is to help steer the trial in a way that we think it should be steered. And for counsel not to even request it at that time, I think it's a very unfair burden to put on a trial judge. In my view, there was no issue.
What's your strongest legal support for the argument that as a matter of law there was a duty here? And that it shouldn't have gone to the jury because it didn't need to, because it was a matter of law. Yes, there is a duty.
I think it's very simply the email, which but for its existence, there would never have been a case. Trial Exhibit 9, the September email string that goes back and forth between Redwood, the lender, and Nova, in which they were asked whether my client, SRRT, could rely on the report in connection with its underwriting for purposes of transferring the property to a related partnership. That in and of itself, in my mind, and as we argued on summary judgment, created the duty. It was clearly foreseeable when Nova knows that the buyer of the property who's getting the mortgage wants to rely on the report for the purpose of underwriting its decision to buy, that eliminates the foreseeability issue. The cases we cite...
What about the relationship issue? I mean, there is no contract between the parties that are represented in courts today. What is the basis of the relationship? I mean, I think foreseeability, I understand your argument. What in those email strings created a relationship on which a duty could be based?
They created the relationship when they agreed that we could rely on their report. That's just simple. For example, in my case, we cite a number of cases about that. And now, of course, I'm having a senior moment and a blank on the name of the accounting case that's the seminal case.
Bonhiever.
Yeah. What, pardon me?
Bonhiever.
Thank you very much, Your Honor. Bonhiever, in which the court said, and I think we underlined it in the quote in our brief, that the mere knowledge by the accountant that, in that case, the Commissioner of Insurance, who was a non-privity, okay, he wasn't hired by the Commissioner of Insurance, the mere fact that the accountant knew that the Commissioner of Insurance would be relying on his work was sufficient to create the relationship, the duty, in negligence. And so in this case, we have exactly the same thing. We have that relationship. They created the relationship. They had every right and ability in the context of that single email, rather than to just say approved, could have said denied, of course, could have said approved with conditions, approved on condition that you sign a copy of the contract that we have and therefore be bound by the terms of the contract. Mr. Murphy could have conditioned on many things, but he did not. And that's what created the issue for the jury that this whole case was fought around.
But weren't they relying upon, or shouldn't they have been relying upon the limits in 2.3, which talks about may rely upon this report, so they added the SRRT, mm-hmm. May rely upon this report in evaluating a request for an extension of credit. That's different than what I understood. And I understand you're throwing, and maybe you can help me with this, the words, well, it's underwriting, and that's somehow maybe the same. But as I, from a high level, understood it, your client said, look, I use this report to decide whether to buy the property at what price. And that was And here it says, note, only rely upon this for evaluating an extension of credit.
I would say two things with respect to that. Number one, they were, my client was, as part of this transaction, guaranteeing this loan and taking on the obligation to repay it. So to that extent, it is part of, quote unquote, evaluating the credit. But secondly, the fact that the email tells Nova the purpose for which SRRT wants to rely on the report, and that is the underwriting. And the testimony at trial was that underwriting is the process we go through to determine, you know, fairness of price, blah, 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 including condition of property, for a transfer of the property, knowing it's going to be transferred from one party to another. It's that confusion, if you will, ambiguity in the whole thing when you read it as a whole, which I think one must do, just like interpreting a contract, one must read it as a whole, that created the fact question, the ambiguity that the trial court said goes to the jury. It went to the jury. It was the most hotly contested issue in the case, and the jury found in favor of the plaintiff.
Through the lens of the reliance and was it reasonable and that kind of thing. I'm still struggling about the question of relationship. I'm looking at Williams versus Smith, which was a 2012 decision of our Supreme Court involving a basketball coach who was sought to be hired by the University of Minnesota, and so there were, you know, meetings between the coach and the university representative about this potential offer, and the claim was ultimately made for negligent misrepresentation, and our Supreme Court declined to find a legal duty, saying these are sophisticated business people on both sides of this discussion about employment and opportunities and options. And doesn't the fact that we're dealing with sophisticated business people who know what a report for extension of a credit is all about, as opposed to what a property appraisal and inspection for purposes of making repairs is, does that make a difference?
I think the cases are distinguishable, and no, I don't think if what you're saying, Your Honor, is that every time there's a transaction between quote unquote sophisticated parties, and where one draws the line on there is another question. But in the Williams versus Smith cases, I understand it. You know, the real issue was whether Coach Smith had the authority to make these representations and to make these issues. In this case, there's no question about that. Mr. Murphy, who agreed to the reliance, is the vice president of Nova, you know, a high officer of the company, the person that they dealt with. And the report itself, Your Honor, and that's why in various respects in our brief, I quoted from the report, because the report makes representations about what its purpose is. It specifically says, we are going to tell you what the condition of the building is. We are going to tell you our estimated cost of making immediate repairs. The report goes on and on and on to tell the reader that we are going to do a thorough job of looking at this building and telling you what the issues with it are. And I guess I don't know. I don't know how else to say it, but the when you take all of this in context, when you take it all together, I think as one has to do, the question of reasonable reliance. I'll keep jumping back to this. Was for the jury, of course. I'm saying that because I won, but if I was on the other side, I might say something different. But you know, this evidence was hotly contested. They were allowed to cross-examine, put in evidence, put on their own expert witnesses. Mr. Murphy testified. The gentleman who said approved testified.
So let me ask you the question a little bit differently. Mm-hmm. And it is, I think, essentially the same thing Judge Bjorkman's asking. But we do have two claims submitted to the jury. You know, we have the negligent misrepresentation, and then we have negligent inspection. Mm-hmm. But as is pointed out by the appellants, you know, the negligent inspection, the inspection occurred well before this email exchange that we're all talking about. So how does a court impose a duty to reasonably inspect and extend that duty to a party that had no contact whatsoever with the inspector at the time of the inspection?
The court did not impose the duty. NOVA imposed the duty on themselves by agreeing that we could rely on their inspection.
You're saying they assumed a duty post-date, and
yes,
that somehow affects, and I guess I have a hard time distinguishing even between your negligent misrepresentation and your negligent inspection claim, because I think you're saying in your negligent inspection claim that they did not summarize accurately the condition of the property in the report.
It went farther than that, Your
Honor. Okay.
And we argued, and I argued this to the jury, is there was a great deal of evidence on it that the inspector, Mr. Spencer, who was a licensed architect, did not adequately perform the inspection, not just write it down. He testified too, and he says, I didn't see this stuff. I didn't see it. We put on the testimony then of Ryan Wagner, the next person that inspects it. He does the exact same inspection, and he sees a lot of different things.
Give me another case where a party assumes a duty, and it preferably post-inspection, but maybe it's a different scenario, but after the act is done and then is legally liable for that. You know, you understand what I'm asking about? It's the post-dating that I'm struggling with.
Yeah, I understand what you're asking, Your Honor.
It's usually perspective,
I do,
right?
And
you assume a duty and then some act happens.
We don't have hardly any that I could find, quote-unquote, negligent inspection cases in appellate court decisions. The closest I can come is Bonhiever versus Graff, or perhaps the Walder Pump case, where
I think the facts in Bonhiever are different. There is no post-dated assumption.
In a sense, there was, because they were relying on an audit that had already been done on behalf of the insurance company who was being audited. Similar in Walder Pump, we've got an engineer who's in a contractual privity with an owner to prepare plans for a building for a project, and then later a subcontractor who doesn't even know about this until, you know, after all those plans are done, all that work's done, the specifications are prepared, and then they're sent out for bid. That subcontractor comes in at a later date and is essentially allowed by the court to rely on that and have a negligence claim against the engineer for negligently preparing those documents in the first instance. Are these analogies directly on point, all four squares? I'm landing on the moon very carefully. No, but I'm not aware of another case that's a negligent inspection case that deals with these issues, so that would be the analogy I would draw, Your Honor. I think I ran out of time, so I'll sit down.
All right, thank you, counsel. Counsel for appellant, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you. Let me see if I can touch quickly on a few of these points, Your Honor. They said that we should have offered a special verdict question on issues that we wanted the jury to decide. We didn't want the jury to decide duty. We didn't want the jury to decide foreseeability. We wanted the court to decide both those questions, and that's what the court didn't do, and that's what we're complaining is an error here. They said, look at the email train, and you'll see that there is an ambiguity here. But that's not the statutory construction rule that should be applied here. We're looking at paragraph 2.3, and the Supreme Court has said in the Metro Sports case, which we cited in the brief, which they don't cite in their brief, it said you look at the provision standing on its own. Was there anything ambiguous about that paragraph? And there's not, because it says what you can we can rely on it for, and it says you can't rely on it for any other purpose. There's nothing ambiguous about that. There is no foreseeability here. You know, what's foreseeable is that parties get their own inspectors. They get their own people. They get their own attorneys. They get whoever they need to represent their interests. They said, and when I say they, Brad Schaefer said, we usually hire a property engineer, but they didn't want to hire him this time because they didn't want to go through the expense. Their own appraiser said, you know, we're not competent to tell you about the structural integrity of this building. You should go out and hire an independent contractor to look at this building and determine whether it's structurally sound. They didn't. They turned to us.
If you would, sure. Would you address the argument that the phrase extension of credit applies to the purchase since SRRT was also kind of, I forget the exact words, but also had this financial interest in securing the loan?
Their interest didn't matter here. We were doing this pursuant to a contract that we had with the lender, and this is what we said to the lender, and the lender that we will not. You shouldn't look at this for any other purpose. We were, whether they guaranteed the loan or not, they didn't have to buy the building. What they're saying is it goes to a different purpose. They're saying it goes to the purposes of if we'll even want to buy the building. They're saying it goes to the purpose of whether we're even going to want to get substantial reduction in the purchase price for it. That's not what this document said. And what they're really asking for is a preferential treatment. They're asking for treatment beyond which anyone else under paragraph 2.3 could get, and that is to use the document for their own purpose and not what is expressed in 2.3. That's the problem here. They said that we contracted to give a thorough review. It's the elephant in the closet. ASTM standard E-2018 tells how we are reviewing this building. It's a walkthrough. We just look around.
You don't get up on scaffolding to look at the exterior.
We don't need scaffolding. We don't need a 50 times magnification camera.
But you argued this. I mean, that evidence was presented to the jury.
Sure, sure.
And they rejected it.
Right, but it goes to the issue of justifiable lines. I mean, I guess what we're saying, Your Honor, at this point is when you add up all the things, add up the fact that they had constructive knowledge of every single problem in that building, because of the interrelationship here, they can't deny that they knew as a matter of law what AMBI told them later, which AMBI should have told them before, because they should have hired AMBI. That was their person. They went to them all the time. They didn't want to pay for AMBI, and so they said, well, maybe we can get the report that the lender got, and we'll use this. It's for a file. We can check a box. We can do this deal. This is a big inside deal, and that's I'm not being critical. These are all related entities working on this deal here. Any other questions for me? I'll sit down. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Thank you both for your helpful arguments. The matter was well presented. We will take the case under advisement and issue our decision within the statutory 90-day period. And I believe that is the last case on our calendar for oral arguments, so we are in recess.
Ben Kirk.
Thank you.
Nice to meet you.